paper emerged out of a classroom discussion at St. Lawrence College in New York, where I taught for a while. So I have to thank my students in an undergraduate seminar there on science studies approaches to environmental studies. So in the paper was inspired by the students in that class. In a unit on natural and unnatural disasters, I assigned two articles on Chernobyl. One of them deals exclusively with human subjects, politics and sufferings in the aftermath of the disaster. It was Adriana Petrina's essays, Biological Citizenship, the Science and Politics of Chernobyl Exposed Populations, from 2004. The other one highlights morphological deformation in insects caused by radiation exposure, Hugh Ruffell's entry on Chernobyl in his Insectopedia. Briefly on Petrina, the rest of the paper will be on Ruffell's Insectopedia. Petrina highlights how scientific attempts to quantify radiation risk in the aftermath of Chernobyl have resulted in appropriation and objectification of suffering and enabled the rational technical management of groups, of suffering and enabled the rational technical management of groups affected by the nuclear disaster in the Ukraine as biological citizens. So here, illness became a form of currency, and healthcare intensified the vulnerability of sufferers from radiation exposure by also promoting economic protection. So care in this case was, or healthcare in this case, was more about the absence of care than care. In his Insectopedia, Hugh Ruffell, that some of you may know, anthropologist Hugh Ruffell, introduces us to Swiss science artist, as she calls herself, and environmental activist, Cornelia Hesse-Honecker. Hesse-Honecker collects and studies and paints morphologically deformed leaf bugs that she finds in the proximity of nuclear power plants. So not only in the aftermath of Chernobyl, but she collects bugs around all kinds of power plants around the world. Her paintings seek to illustrate the long-term low-dose effects of radiation on bugs. And here's one of these deformed bugs. You see here differently sized and proportioned wings as one of the deformations. It's important to note, though, that while these bugs are important as biosensors, or could be regarded as biosensors for low-dose nuclear radiation, Hesse-Honecker cares tremendously about these bugs. Back to the classroom, I could have not anticipated the classroom discussion that follows the juxtapositioning of these two completely different articles. So my original plan, and it was an environmental studies class, not an animal studies class, was to discuss different roles of science in anti-nuclear politics, different notions of expertise, modes of activism. But that was almost completely off the table after the students expressed their bafflement, even indignation, with Ruffell's piece. Who cares about bugs? So especially in the face of human tragedy that has been unfolding in the aftermath of Chernobyl and the horrific health effects like thyroid cancer from creeping low-dose exposure. So emotions ran high. And one of my most outspoken and self-assured students set the tone and topic for the discussion. She affirmed that she cares about humans, and perhaps biodiversity, but not particularly about bugs. Many other students agreed, and I was in trouble. I was all baffled in a way, because I don't know how many of you have read the Insectopedia. Reading Ruffell is, I was assuming it automatically makes you care. Right, so I'm asking myself, what is it that makes you care? First, a quick mini-lecture on the ecological entanglements of humans and non-human well-beings, supported by a short YouTube video on the environmental effects of Chernobyl, appeased most of my students. It wasn't difficult for them to understand in functional ecological terms that the livelihood of many earthlings, and this is Bruno Latour's term, are intimately connected. We have talked about species extinction and the Anthropocene. It made sense to most of the students that the well-being of other critters ultimately affects humans too, but it didn't help. It didn't help at all rendering Ruffell's account and Hesse-Honecker's engagement with insect more intelligible or sensible to them. The students responded emotionally. Functional relationship of codependence remained unconvincing. But this would have not been Ruffell's point. His entry is first of all about the vulnerability of leaf bugs, and only maybe secondly about their utility as biological, as biosensors for radiation for humans. So, but why would he devote such a last portion of this chapter to Hesse Honecker's painting practice? And how would this relate to scientific expertise on one hand and to forms of artistic expression on the other? The students were wondering. So I try again. Ruffell doesn't necessarily suggest what to care about. Well, he does that too. But rather explores how to care, how care as a mode of engagement might be practiced in the production of evidence for radiation risk. So while I was trying to draw the attention to the role of care and knowledge practices and knowledge politics, the students wanted to talk about ethics. That is, who deserves our care and our protection? So this paper is then, and there's a longer version of it, is an attempt to develop a framework for a more appropriate response. So is there a way to attend simultaneously to questions of ethics in human-animal relationships and to care and knowledge production? So I offer a notion that I take from Jacques Derrida, abyssal intimacy as a key concept for a reading of Ruffell's chapter that combines the ethical question between human and animal relationships with question of careful knowledge production. So what I'm trying to do with this concept is at least twofold. There are many different angles to it. So it tries to deconstruct or tries to suggest a relationship between humans and non-humans that is both intimate and strange or groundless and abyssal. But then it also, at the same time, relates to a knowledge production that is intimate knowledge, is Ruffell's term in a different part of his work, that deconstructs the opposition between activity and passivity in knowledge production and attachment and detachment. So it's supposed to do a lot of work, and I'm trying to get this out of a reading of Ruffell's chapter. But first, I want to take a closer look at what prevented the students from caring about leaf bugs? What assumptions did they make about possible relationships between humans and non-humans? As Carol Adams observes, feminist writer, in the face of a human tragedy, concerns about the suffering of animals are usually experienced as offense to the human victims. And that's exactly how the students reacted. They were almost offended that anybody could care about bugs in the face of these horrific images of this tragedy. And so they were thinking that in order to care about bugs, they somehow have to sacrifice the sympathies for human victims. The student written responses clarified some of the background assumption, the framework from which they were arguing. So most unsettling in their written responses was that there was an implicit assumption that compassion for leaf bugs would require an undifferentiated appreciation of all forms of life according to some universal principle of equality. One student wrote, quote, "It was difficult for me to see the suffering of the leaf bugs and the suffering of human victims on equal plane." Another student went further, asserting that he would have liked to, but wouldn't even consider equality between leaf bugs and humans. So he wrote, "After reading Petrina, it was difficult for me, even though I would have liked to contemplate the idea of giving equal consideration to Hesse Honecker's leaf bug and the human victims of radiation exposure who suffered from thyroid cancer." So these comments are deeply informed by a liberal tradition that grants formal equality to all human beings on a social contract that presupposes autonomy and the possibility of reciprocity. And the possibility of reciprocity. So they're clearly what would be a society in which leaf bugs couldn't become citizens. So Carol Adams refers to this conservative economy of compassion, as if there wouldn't be enough compassion to go around. So why should compassion be limited is the question here. A certain assumption was made about the temporal orientation of care. Given Heather Honecker's environmental activism, the student assumed that caring about bugs involved acting on their behalf. They confused care here with a specific kind of advocacy that is not only motivated but also teleological and directly leads to helping action. So one must distinguish here caring about and caring for, right? So I'm talking about caring about rather than caring for. From the student's point of view, Heather Honecker failed this assumption twice. First, it seems inexcusable for them that she wants to speak for the bugs and advocate on behalf of the bugs rather than on behalf of human victims. Secondly, it remains rather unclear what exactly she's advocating. Philosopher and animal advocate Lori Green seems to support the student's assumption when she asserts, quote, "I can't connect with embryonic stem cells or microbes, even though they are part of me, and my connection to bugs is thin. I'm not moved to act for their sakes if there are other conflicting values," end quote. So a related assumption was that the presumed need to specify our subject of care before we begin to care. So whom exactly should we care about? Individual bugs, particular species of leaf bugs, or only those that suffer deformation? So the crucial question here is not how to care well. So it's not about caring for, but caring about. But how to begin to care about others we did not care about before. So the students probably never heard about leaf bugs before they were asked to read this text. So the notion of care I'm interested in here is not something that takes time as caring for in maintenance work, but something that makes time differently. And according, one meaning of care, according to the OED, is to trouble. And it also means to trouble in post-humanist circles, it also means to trouble oneself or trouble the self. So what I'm trying to suggest in different readings, and I can't go into the details here, that thinking of care as in terms of trouble, there are Raffles chapters have different ways to begin to care in terms of different ways of dealing with trouble. So in one, the first one focuses on the possibility with empathy for leaf bugs. The second one about knowledge production that in which tension are maintained, in which contradictions in careful knowledge production trouble. And the third one is what I call a new sensibility that I often did I call abyssal intimacy. But not all of the students were indignated. Some of them were actually deeply moved by Raffles' account. And one of them observes rather astutely, there's something about his writing that generates care. Raffles' work has been referred to as poetic ethnography. When pushed a bit further, however, he affirmed that caring as a matter of empathy engendered by the possibility of identification with the person Heather Honecker and through her with the bugs. Now, empathy plays a role in Raffles' account. We learn, for example, and I put this quote on there, when she, Heather Honecker, is outside collecting in fields at roadside and on the edges of forest, she loses herself in the animal. At that moment, she says she feels very connected, extremely connected, feels a deep bond as if perhaps she herself had once been such a creature, a leaf bug, and had a body remembering. And further on, Raffles suggests that this connection is indeed a very personal one. When her son was born, the doctor came into her room and made a drawing for her to break the news that her child had a club foot. And how, when she saw that the first deformed leaf bug in Sweden, it had a crippled foot too. Now, For some of the, well, aren't these experiences, however, rather idiosyncratic, one may ask. For some of the students, these shoes of leaf bugs seem just a bit too small or irrelevant. So rather than highlighting empathy, Ruffles elaborates on different kinds of intimacies. Collecting bugs created one kind of intimacy, and the intense attention of painting another kind of intimacy. Both are processes of affect and knowledge production. Collecting is pictured as personal obsession, creating and demanding ecological behavioral knowledge. Ruffles is, however, much more interested in the second kind of intimacy. We don't learn much about the life of leaf bugs. Here, empirical information about how they make a living is not what solicits care. It also does not matter how closely they are related to us or how exactly they feel or do not feel pain. We are simply informed that they are exceptional biological indicators. They are exceptionally vulnerable to radioactive contaminants taken up by the plants on which they live. So instead, we learn some details about concrete art, which is an aesthetic tradition that emerged in the 1930s around Swiss painter Max Bill, in which Hesse Honecker was trained. Concrete or non-objective art is an attempt to break with the conservatism of representational art, Ruffles explains. Quote, concrete paintings tend to with geometric pattern, high contrast color blocks, glossy planes, and the refusal of a figurative or even metaphorical reference. Concrete paintings depict neither natural phenomena nor abstractions. They are not tied to an object, nor do they transform or mimic the object, as abstract paintings do. They refuse symbolic reference. There is no light and shadow, which would render them historical, capturing and freezing a moment in time. Rather, color perspective renders them timeless, outside time. So the work, quote, referenced nothing outside itself. Concrete art not only breaks with representationalism, but also with historicism. The deformed insect becomes a unique event in her paintings. So for Hesse Honecker, painting is research. Here she at work. A form of active or visual seeing grounded in close observation of nature. Her scientific approach to art may recall Bruno's Latour's conception of scientific experiment as both a craft and an event. But Latour's notion of an event implies a frozen moment in time. Here, her painting practices appear to engender events outside of time. So highlighting the deformed morphology of the insect rather than their ecology, her painting practice involves an experience almost opposite to that of collecting. Ruffles tells us, quote, when she sits down with her microscope, she no longer experiences the insect as co-evolved being, but as form and color, shape and texture and quantity and volume, plane and aspect. So now care in Hesse Honecker's painting practice remains inconceivable without attention to passion and passivity. On one hand, the intimacy in painting of her deformed bugs involves a focused attention to the particularities of the individual insect and a high degree of geometric precision. On the other hand, it entails an active withdrawal of herself, freeing the painting of her presence. In addition, quote, she sees everything as if for the first time, Ruffles informs us. Freeing herself from all prior assumptions, she thrives to completely open to what is in front of her so that the insect can be itself without judgment. This, however, also seems to remove her environmental politics and her sympathies for the animal from the image. So at times, this description read of the painting practice, the description read as a commitment to the most conventional forms of scientific objectivity aimed at an illusion of neutrality through the erasure of the subject of investigation. The motivation of her scientific art, however, seemed diametrically opposed to that, opposed to the one of objective science. So rather than getting closer to the object in front of her, she seeks to create a radical break with any kind of objectivity, removing the object completely from the scene. So So rather than becoming subjects, the insect is offered as pure aesthetic logic, as coalescence of form, color, and angle. That was also a quote. So, however, there are also apparent failures and frustrations, not merely partial failures through which judgments might sneak back into the picture, but complete failures. So rather than being all about the individual leaf bud, the paintings become all about structure, the exposure of deformation, environmental politics, a matter of concern. Quote, too effectively standing in for human fears and too readily bringing viewers' self-concern to the fore, they elicit the wrong response. Well, at other moments, they are just art. Everything is always so focused on those watercolors, has a Honecker laments. The insects become merely vehicles for artistic expression. On display, then, Raphael remarks, almost in passing, a label that identifies the date and site of its collection, as well as its irregularities, ground the atemporal image in place and politics. The paintings seem mutually dispassionate, resolutely documentary. Now, at the same time, Raphael suggests, so thoroughly in the world, they shimmer with emotion. On first sight, then, it seems a proper contextualization that insists on the importance of particular times and places reconciles scientific objectivity here with anti-nuclear politics and has a harness effectively charged engagement with the insect. On second sight, it reads care in these paintings manifests itself as struggle, a struggle between artistic creation and scientific observation, between subjectivity and objectivity, intense engagement and the withdrawal of herself, an attempt to do justice to the individual deformed box and its representation as an icon that stands in for all to human concern. A struggle to simultaneously provide scientific evidence for the effects of long-term low-dose radiation on living beings and to solicit compassion for leaf bugs. So in holding on to these contradictions, Raphael seems to want to preserve Hesse Honecker's struggles in his rendering of her aesthetic epistemic ethics, making it visible in her paintings through his narrative, but also showing Hesse Honecker as a person full of contradiction. So that might be one way to figure the temporality of care as some wavering, oscillating, vibrating presence full of internal tension. Now, on the third side, I'm arguing, another reading is possible, one that renders care neither as a struggle of oppositional impulses nor the management of contradiction, but rather a break with oppositional logic itself. Such a break manifests itself in some of which are called the more Derridian moments in Raphael's text, moments of relief in which opposition cease to confront each other as exteriorities, but rather become folded into each other, becoming conditions of possibility of each other. I'm almost done, sorry. In one of those moments, Raphael asserts her method is both highly precise in the sense that the outcome is contingent on what is present under the microscope and substantially random. It is not unusual that after finishing a painting, she discovered that the insect is deformed in ways she hadn't noticed before. So in systematically complementing precision with randomness, as a Honecker's self-withdrawal is no longer opposable to judgments about the exposure of deformities, but becomes a condition of possibility, such as the insect may contribute to its visible renderings. So rather than being completely open only to what is in front of her, she seems to be able to listen to that which is still to come behind or besides herself, to that which befalls her as an event or as a surprise. So in this way, seeing in her painting practice becomes visceral through an active desubjectification that allows for a passive decision coming from the other within. So the dead insect, she's painting dead insects here. Body, neither subject nor object, becomes a most engaging being. That's a quote from Haraway, leaving inherently indeterminate the source of activity and who engages whom. And finally, we learned that Hesse Honecker's art is actually neither concrete nor naturalistic. And yet, and here's a long quote from Raphael, almost done, worth reading fully. And yet, he asserts, somehow the portraits also achieve a doubling, a breaching of the lines between humans and human and animal. These intensely direct paintings embedded too strongly in fears of invisible poison and malevolent corporate power, enforce identifications across the most radical of gaps by insisting on the most fundamental of commonalities, physical vulnerability and mortality, and by evoking a sense of humility in the face of complex beauty. Her portrayals and the controversy she generates around them force people to transcend species difference by recognizing a conjoined fate, a common witnessing, a shared victimhood. So it is quite unsettling, the eye of the painter and the viewer suspended between the clinical and the empathetic. A loss of stable distinction between subject and object, between human and insects, between intimacy and distance. So the point here is, just one more comment and then I'm done, that the viewer is suspended in a zone of indeterminacy. Okay, I'm gonna skip that. That introducing a delay, a questioning any self-presence of the human subject within, before, or behind the painting. The paintings move us, but they do not necessarily move us in time. They prompt us to immediate react. They don't prompt us to immediate reaction, literal movement, as if we already knew in advance what would be the right thing to do about low-dose radiation exposure, for example. I'll leave it here.
Thank you, Astrid. Sorry. No.